Good afternoon and welcome. This session is about open source philosophy and its application to the Java platform. This session will be going on for the next 50 minutes in here. Then immediately after this session, we'll be running a discussion panel with Eben Moglen from the Free Software Foundation and Cliff Schmidt from the Apache Software Foundation, talking about open source licensing principles and futures, giving an opportunity for audience discussion and questions. So we have the full 2 hours of open source and licensing discussion. If that was not the destination you were expecting when you boarded the plane, then please now step towards the exit and allow one of the stewardesses to take you to another room. But if that was the place that you wanted to go to, then we'll begin. What I'm going to be talking about here is I'm going to be talking about what free software and open source development will mean to the Java platform. And more than that, I'll be talking about the opportunity that is being opened up by the move of the Java platform to become free software under the GPL. My name's Simon Phipps, and I'm Sun's chief open source officer. That means it's my responsibility to try and herd cats into open source boxes at Sun, to give the advice that the product groups need to head in the direction of open source, and to work with free software and free software communities. To give you a bit of my background, before I joined Sun, I used to work for IBM, and back in 1995, I was involved with a group of good fellows who are represented in the room, in fact, who work over at IBM, porting the Java platform there. And I joined Sun in 2000. I was recruited to try and get Java open source, and it's only taken 7 years. That's pretty prompt work there. So let's think about open source software, and let's think about what it is that's driving the move to open source software. And what's driving the move to open source software is a change in the way that the world functions. You see, what's been going on is that we have seen a huge surge of energy into the social dynamics of the world around us, being caused by the convergence of Tim Berners-Lee's little idea, World Wide Web, and the pervasive availability of broadband internet. And those two things together have reversed a trend that has been present in society for the last couple of hundred years. In Western society, certainly before the Industrial Revolution, the way that society worked was a mesh of people who would interact with each other on a scale roughly sized around about the distance that word could travel in a day. And society was made up of many meshes of relationship between people who knew each other well. What happened at the Industrial Revolution is that the architecture, the topology of society became a hub and spoke architecture, with the centralization of control at the center of the wheel, and then with the recipients of the control at the spokes. And so government turned into this model. We had the emergence of democracy, actually meaning a centralized government rather than a distributed government. That was a kind of different to how things were before, because there were in most countries centralized governments of one kind or another. Most law was conducted on a local basis. Similarly, this also produced a change in the way stuff got made. It meant that there was centralized production and then distribution network that allowed things to be made repeatedly using mass labor and then distributed high profit, sometimes at low cost, to the people at the ends of the spoke. And that carried on for many years, but then the availability of the World Wide Web and broadband internet changed the way that that worked and turned us from a hub and spoke architecture into a peer-to-peer architecture. Only this time around, the mesh of people is a mesh where the boundaries are defined less by distance that word can travel in a day, which now is anywhere around the world, and is defined more by a set of social connections between the participants in the mesh. So if you've read a book by Cory Doctorow called Eastern Standard Tribe, you'll hear him defining the social groupings in society as being based on which time zone you are awake in. And so I happen to live in the UK, but I'm part of probably Eastern Standard Tribe, because everyone I work with is in California, and so I go to bed when they go home, and I am part of that tribe of people who are awake in Eastern Standard Time. So society was pushed into a mesh of people, and what has gradually happened, the inexorable direction of things are going, is the equalization of the power within that mesh, brought about by transparency. The move, the power of transparency is actually huge. One of the things that's happened in the UK is the introduction of a website called theyworkforyou.com. And I'm able to go to this website and register my postal code, and I can subscribe to an RSS feed where I will see everything that my representative in the Houses of Parliament has been saying every day. And I can see what he's talking about. I can see where his passions are. I can tell that his passions are not the same as my passion. You know, an MP in a city constituency, he has a lot of interest in rural affairs, and that's fascinating. That transparency is shining a light on the way that government is happening in the UK, as is the petition website that the Prime Minister has set up. And we're gradually seeing democracy turning into a mesh of individuals. And that movement is happening all around the world, with the transparency brought about by a meshed society shining a light into dark places. And that's also happening in the world of software. So what's happening in the world of software is that we are beginning to see ecosystems of software developers who are collaborating together over software springing up. The way that used to develop software in the old days was by hiring all the smart people and locking them in a room and sliding pizza under the door until they had written whatever it was that you wanted written. But today, well, you know, Bill Joyce said you can't hire all the smart people. Some of the smart people inevitably work elsewhere. And that didn't used to matter because they would simply work for another centralized hub somewhere. It didn't really touch your business too much. But today, statistically, the number of smart people you can hire rounds to zero, and all the smart people you can't hire are on a mailing list working on the same software as you. If you are working on some software which does not require the unique skills of one or two individuals, it is highly likely that it will be more productive for developers in the open room gathering together in a collaborative context working on a very well-structured, subdivided software project will be able to produce better software than you can working in your closed room, a culture that is under corporate thumb. And so that is the world of open source. It is the world of collaborative development brought about not by some desire to subvert the world, but simply by the fact that everyone has joined up to everybody else. So to give you a picture of how this works, let's take a look at a typical open source ecosystem. And you'll see that we've gone in the ultra high quality graphics here as opposed to my normal stick figures, so thank you, Patrick. Software always starts with a creative individual. And that creative individual will be creating a piece of software that is meeting a particular need that she has got for maybe a client, maybe for her own business. She will develop that software and she will be committed and passionate and expert in making that software work. She uses that software to create a free source commons. And other people are now able to watch as she develops that software that's in use for her business. Before long, some other guy comes along, and he looks at that software, and he realizes it would be the perfect starting point for something he wants to do. So he takes that software, and he modifies it. He adds a little bit here. He fixes a few bugs there. And before long, he has got a piece of software which is the perfect answer to a business problem that he was facing. That's where the story ended. There'd be nothing remarkable here. But he realizes that actually, every change he makes has now got a life of its own. It is going to need sustaining. As changes flow through from the commons, each change that he has made is going to need regression testing. As the code commons builds, every change that he has made is going to need refactoring. It is going to need maintaining within the context of the larger body of code. And as the code commons changes more and more and more, he has to gain more and more skills in the know-how of the general commons, until ultimately he'll find himself having on board within his own resources or within his company all of the skills that are in the community in order to maintain this body of improvements he's made against the open source code commons. And he realizes that that's a recipe for bankruptcy. If you get caught in regression test hell because you have decided to fork a code commons, you discover the costs rapidly mount up, and the cost that you will have to face is a cost similar to creating the proprietary software in the closed room. And so this guy is smart, and he decides that instead of keeping his changes to himself, he's going to contribute them back. And he contributes them back not because he is an altruist, not because he is the world's greatest philanthropist, but because he realizes the best way to produce great software is to contribute back. If you don't contribute back, you end up in regression test hell. And this is the key dynamic of an open source community. Open source is not about using software that you got for free. Open source is about creating a work that brings value to you and sustaining it by leveraging the network of other developers in the community. You're not abusing them, you are simply cooperating with them in co-maintaining, co-developing the software that you're working on. Other people can show up in the community. This guy down here is an educator. He can look at the source code. Doesn't do anyone any harm him doing so. It's a thoroughly good thing. This person over here believes that they're going to rule the world by taking this code base proprietary, that they're going to produce a category-beating version of whatever the thing is. Maybe they're going to produce some kind of an application server that is going to be the best ever. And they create their proprietary product, but they quickly discover that the cost of maintaining all of that code outweighs the benefit that they're getting. The Apache Software Foundation told me they've looked back at their 10-year history and they haven't seen any example of someone forking an Apache code base and keeping going with it as fork of the Apache code base without contributing code back in the end. They say that everyone either gives up or gives back. There isn't a third way. And so the process continues. More and more people deploying the software, improving it, developing it, fixing bugs in it, and ultimately contributing to the community. Not because they want to give away stuff, but because contributing back reduces your cost and allows you to leverage the network effect of the community. To boil that down to a single diagram, open source is a virtuous cycle seeded by an initial contribution and resulting in a source code commons, which is licensed under a free software license and which is then used by communities of developers to create software that produces wealth for them. By wealth, I'm using the term wealth here the way that Paul Graham does in his book Hackers and Painters, to describe a condition where you create something that makes you feel rich. Some people feel rich when they bring literacy and employment to an urban area. Some people feel rich when they're bridging the digital divide. Some people feel rich when they get a bonus from their employer. Some people feel rich when they're able to get an income from a client that lets them pay off part of their mortgage. Whatever it is that makes you feel rich, you will be motivated to participate in this cycle, not by an abstract desire to touch code, but by some personal motivation which is leading you to feel richer because you participated. And in the open source community, everyone is there with their individual motivations, and I don't care what they are. Your motivations are your problem. My motivations are mine, and your contributions are your problem, and mine are mine, until the point where we've put them in the commons and they become ours. And so the key to an open source community is people deriving works under an open source license and then contributing code back under the terms of a governance to an open source code commons. That virtuous cycle lies at the heart of every open source project. That then drives a change in the way that the software market worked. When I started in the computer industry quite a long time ago, computers came with all the software they needed to work. In the bottom of the box, there was a mag tape. You would eventually work out how to boot the computer and mount the mag tape, get the software off, and build something you could deploy out to your business. The time that you paid for that software that you were deploying was the time that you bought the hardware. It seemed that the software was free because it came with the hardware, but actually the cost of developing it was included in the cost of creating the computer system. In the 1980s, that changed and the software was unbundled from the computer system. And what happened was that people would select a computer and they would select software to run on it to solve a business problem. And they would pay for a software license up front that gave them the right to then deploy the software together with the computer to solve a business problem. So in the 1980s, the point that software compensation was received by the software developers was the point that a license was purchased right up front in the process. And then it was up to the software developer to extract the value necessary for the business. See, it turns out that no one ever wanted to actually buy a software license. I mean, no one wants to put the software license on their wall. What businesses typically want is a working payroll or a working CRM system, not some software licenses. Actually, they don't even want a working CRM system. What they actually want is a well-lubricated path from the customer's pocket into their bank account. And the software is just one of the costs that they have to face in making that happen. And so ultimately, a pressure has come about because of the way that developers create open source software in open source communities. To make that virtuous cycle work, all the software has to be available without any barriers. And if there were any barriers there, the developers co-creating the software together would not be able to work together. So the software is available without charge and without encumbrance. But actually, people who are deploying the software can get it under the same terms. It was never meant to be that way. The software is available without encumbrance so that the co-developers can work on it. But it turns out that the deployer developers are able to get it that way as well. And so what happens is that the time that compensation is received from software in the new business model moves away from the time of acquisition of the software and begins to move down the life cycle of the software to the point where people buy update subscriptions, to where people buy service contract, to where people buy defect resolution services or indemnity. All open source business models rely on the transition of the point of payment from a point of acquisition at the front of the process to some point of value within the process. Open source software is not free in the sense that you don't pay for it. It is actually the case that the point of payment is distributed into the life cycle and spread across the user base. There is still the need for the transition of funds there, because not everyone has the skills necessary to make and deploy the software. But the time you choose to do it varies. And that's what brings benefit to end users. End users love open source software, not because they love having 6 million lines of extra source code. I've yet to meet a CIO who wants that to happen to him. Instead, the reason that people who are end users love open source software is they don't have to buy a bundle anymore. They don't have to buy the glossy box that's got all the stuff in it, or that is purported to have all the stuff in it. They don't have to buy what is called a pig in a poke. They don't have to buy a coupon book for future promised value, because that's what that software has turned into. You buy a license and you're told, oh yes, it comes with indemnity and installability and documentation and training and support. And you try and claim on any of those things, and you define that many of them are illusory, and many of them turn out to need payment further down the value chain. Well, open source software ends that. It lets end users decide what they're going to pay for. There will be some things that are critical to the business and are beyond the skills of the staff for which you will need to buy a service from a vendor. There are other things that are well within the scope of the skills of staff you hire, where you can hire in to have the work done. And there are some things that are of no value to you anyway, as far as you're concerned. If the problem arises, you'll buy per incident support, and you just decide to punt and take a risk on those expenses. And in the open source model, for end users, it's not about getting free stuff, it's about getting control over what you pay for. That is what is really key for end users about open source software. And if you hear CIOs talking about thinking they're going to reduce their costs by not having to pay for software licenses anymore, they're thinking wrong. Open source is about getting control over what you do pay for, what you hire for, and what you don't pay for. And that is a sustainable way of keeping your costs under control as you're deploying software. So open source software means different things to these three different communities. For the co-developer community, open source software means being able to join in the co-creation of software because of the rights given to you by the license and the freedoms guaranteed to you by the community governance. For deployers, open source software means being able to build software like a diner at a buffet, being able to pick things onto the plate and selecting them to assemble a solution. Maybe one of these three databases. Let's pick from amongst these five application servers. Let's pick one of these juicy operating systems. People combine them together to produce a solution and then pay for whatever they need to pay for to keep it in production. And that's the part that the user community loves. The user community loves the fact that they pay for what gives them value and they don't pay for all the rest of it. That's where the cost saving comes from. It's actually about control. So as we've been working through on the Java platform over the years, and interestingly, I haven't lost my hair in this process. I've lost my mind, but not my hair. The Java platform has now been around for a considerable amount of time. When I first encountered it in 1995, we had just cancelled a wonderful project that was to do with video conferencing at the labs working, and I found myself working instead on evaluating this new programming language from Sun. And we were able to implement that programming language on top of OS2 and AIX because it came with full source code. We were able to go in and get our hands on the code and go implement it straight away. 1995 was several years before the popularization of the free model for software. And so Java was something of a revolution in 1995. It presented the living proof that controlling the source and keeping it secret was not necessarily a business advantage. Java spread as it did because the source code was available. Now, it was available on licensing terms that were not the same as the open source licensing terms that later would become popularized in 1998 and 1999. But nonetheless, the power of Java in 1995 was available, and we could all port it. And so from the beginning of the year in 1995, the labs where I was working, we had it ported to three different operating systems, and we were able to prove to our management the power of separating the software from the underlying operating system, the power that Java was going to bring to isolate all of the change that happens, the churn that happens in the platform from the applications that run on top of it. And so Java has evolved down that timeline, and so too the world of free and open source software has evolved. It has evolved from the earliest days of common feeling of a need for transparency and openness into a formalization around about the turn of the century, a set of licenses, and into now something which is a full-scale driver for a new way of doing business. When I say a driver for a new way of doing business, let me be clear to you about what I mean by that. In China, 4 years ago, the Chinese economy was using 95+% foreign-sourced software. software. Last year, the Chinese government was using 70% open source software. There is a profound transition happening in Asia, in the rapidly evolving economies, that is using open source as a powerhouse. And if we want to do business in those new markets, let's just not worry about the North American and European market for a moment, where there is also change happening. In those rapidly emerging economies, if you want to do business, open source software is just a basic hygiene factor, and you'd better have an answer ready when they ask. So that is the world that we've moved along. In 2007, we're in a world where open source style licensing is now a prerequisite for your presence in an environment. And that means that the time is now right for the Java platform to become free software. We've done something absolutely amazing by open sourcing the JDK today. What we've done is we have opened up the complete GNU Linux market to your products, endeavors, and skills. Whatever your connection is with the Java platform, we have, at the press of a button opening up the openjdk.java.net site this morning, we have made sure that there is no longer a barrier preventing the JRE from being on any platform on the planet. And that has opened up so much more opportunity. What's more, on GNU Linux, we've also ensured that there is a full Java EE implementation available, and we've also made sure that there is a Java ME implementation available, and we've also made sure that there is a tool which is as powerful as Adobe Flash going to be made available on top of the platform for creating interfaces and content in a way that Java programmers have only dreamed of before. Just think of the opportunity that we are talking about here. Think of the growth of the opportunity. Think of the ability to engage with that opportunity. It's no longer something which is being created separately from us in the community. It is now being created by us in the community. OpenJDK gives us the opportunity to change from being deployer developers into being co-developers, if that's more appropriate to the work that we're doing with the code. So the time is right. The Java platform is in a whole load more anywheres than it was before, so writing once runs in a whole lot more places. The fact that the Java platform is now free software gives us access to developers, to markets, to ideas that were just not available to us before. And it opens up this platform for us to innovate, to co-develop on. The potential is just huge. So what happens when you converge together the different trends of software industry? What happens when the open source movement touches the new world of Java? Java is there on 4 billion devices, on 8 out of 10 cell phones. It is in the hands of, I think, 6 million Java platform developers. What happens when suddenly that and the power of GNU Linux and open source movement meet with each other? Well, that is a point of phenomenal opportunity. I was down in Brazil recently, and I don't know whether this is turning into Brazil one, is it? Whether it is or not. I have noticed that when I say Brazil in these sessions, no one stands up and cheers, which is very, very sad. So I was down in Brazil recently for a conference called FISLE, which is a very big free software conference. There are about 5,000 free software developers down in Porto Alegre in the south of Brazil. And I started finding out about some of the things that had happened since we did the distro license for Java. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but around about a year ago, we wrote a new yet another license for the previous proprietary Java platform that allowed us to distribute the binary JRE with Debian GNU Linux. And this actually, it turns out, had a huge impact in Brazil, because up until that point, the only way that you had been able to interact with your bank online or with the tax authority or to a great degree with the health services was by using a Java applet in a browser. Only, well, lots of people had bought computers under a government scheme that meant that those computers came with GNU Linux on them, and they didn't have Java on them. And so there were countless thousands of Brazilian citizens who had a great computer that had been funded by the government, but they couldn't access the health service, the tax service, or access their bank account details. And at a stroke, DLJ put Java in all of those places and allowed that economy to take off. And it is now creating massive opportunity there for people to deploy Java software across a broad range of devices, bridging the divide between proprietary and free software, bridging the divide between different versions of software within those platforms. And what we're now seeing is that in Brazil, there is a great deal of investment in basic infrastructure on the Java platform. I'm hopeful it's going to become the first true Java-powered economy. And, you know, it's not such a bad place to live if you were thinking of moving. Part of the work that we did there then allowed us to get the Java platform into Ubuntu GNU Linux. So a couple of weeks back, we were able to announce that the new Ubuntu Feisty 4 now had all of the Java packages that made up a complete Java stack included in the repositories. So you can install install Java SE with just a click in Synaptic Package Manager. You can use apt-get to install Java EE GlassFish. Much more importantly, you can make either of those things a prerequisite of your application. So deploying your application on Ubuntu has now become a simple matter of creating a .deb package for your program and placing in there dependencies on Java EE or Java SE. In actual fact, it's become the case, I believe, that GNU Linux has become an easier place to deploy Java applications than Windows, because now you can reuse the power of the package management system to meet all of those dependencies and not have to manage them all yourself. That's simple also to install NetBeans. You can just apt-get NetBeans and put it onto the system. So all of that change is producing an incredible opportunity. We've solved some very basic, what look like really simple problems, and unleashed a load of potential. Now, if you'd be wondering about why we're doing this, well, look at what platforms are going to be used as embedded operating systems. If you're going to start writing embedded applications, where are they going to start showing up? And according to a survey that Ziff Davis did, we've discovered that the Linux platform is going to be a primary place that Java applications will need to be deployed by 2008. And so, again, by putting it in this place, we have opened up new technical capability, and we have grown the opportunity and strength of the Java community. You could say that what we have done here is we have liberated the Java platform. That's certainly what my friends from the Free Software Foundation say. We've also liberated the existing Java community. It's no longer trapped in the boxes that it was before. It's able to spread the boundaries and get out. And, well, who can say what's going to happen in the future? The Java platform was always open in the past. That was how we managed to make it happen on OS2 and on AIX and on System 390 and on then Sun, on Solaris in all its various flavors. That's why there is Java on Windows. But now the Java platform is also free. And that's not my opinion. That's the opinion of the guy that defined the term free in this particularly unique way. So now the way that we've chosen to license the Java platform is with GPLv2. And using GPLv2 was a controversial choice when we made that decision. The reason that we used GPLv2 was primarily because that meant that we could distribute on GNU Linux. That was the number one reason for using GPLv2. There were some other reasons for using GPLv2 though. One of the reasons for using GPLv2 was that it discourages people from creating proprietary forks. It does that by forcing forking behavior to be done in public, like by bringing transparency and daylight into attempts to create a fork of the platform, because the GPL requires that when you distribute binary thing, you have to make sure that all of the source that goes with the creation of that binary thing is also available. And that means that if you are a monopolistic corporation trying to make a hostile fork of the Java platform, well, you have to do it in public, in the full gaze of daylight. You can't suddenly spring it on everyone Monday. And it's our view that as long as the OpenJDK community is imbued with a good governance structure and good set of rules for people to be able to co-create the platform together, that the need for a necessary fork will be eliminated. So we believe that the GPL gives us the greatest ability to discourage hostile community-damaging fork while also encouraging positive behaviors. We've also added the ClassPath exception to the class libraries on Java SE. The ClassPath exception is something that was created by GCJ community a long time ago and then adopted by the ClassPath class libraries. And what it does is it turns the GPL into a less aggressive license for specific uses. It allows you to combine things with libraries without having the need to carry the GPL licensing requirement onto your derived work. So the class path exception means that the positive behavior that we want to see from the GPL is kept within the boundaries of the OpenJDK project and is not transmitted to the applications that you run on top of Java. And so you can still have whatever programs you want running on top of the Java platform, but if people want to work on OpenJDK, they need to do so in the full gaze of daylight, publishing their source code. So the class path exception is the little piece of magic that allows the GPL to be the absolutely perfect license for the Java platform if we are going to grow the market into GNU Linux. So what does this mean for the JCP? Well, it doesn't actually mean anything for the JCP at this stage, in my view. The JCP is a standards process which is defining what is in Java. What we have put into OpenJDK is our implementation of a batch of those standards. The licensing and the governance rules apply to the implementation. The way that the standards are created remains the same for the time being. Now, it's entirely possible that the JCP is in need of some revision and some review, but it is unrelated to what is happening inside OpenJDK at the moment. We can assume that the JCP community is going to govern itself in a way that is smart. I do hope they do. So what is free software now for Java? Well, Java SE, as of this morning, is free software under the GPL v2. We published the Java C compiler and the Hotspot virtual machine and Java help back in November 2006. And we published the full source of the class libraries, less a few encumbrances, this morning. And it's all now out there on openjdk.java.net. We've also open sourced the Java ME platform, that's CDC and CLDC. You'll find both of CDC and CLDC at the Phone ME project on java.net, or phone me if you prefer. Actually, don't phone me, send me email. And then we've also released the Java EE platform. And Java EE was actually the first to be released. It was released under the CDDL license in June 2005, and then last year in November we announced that we were also going to apply the GPL to it. So this means that the complete top-to-bottom Java application stack and runtime environment is available under the GPL, and that's why we've been able to put it into GNU Linux, and that's why you can now develop applications and deploy them on top of those platforms without any fuss. So that's everything that I was going to say there about the open sourcing of the Java platform. I'd like to thank you very much for listening, and now I would be very happy to entertain some questions about the changes that we've made, because I found lots of people have had them. So if you would like to come stand at one of the microphones, and that way I get to hear the question too.
There are these different vendors that actually come up with different VM implementations. WebLogic has its own JVM stack and all that kind of stuff, and they say that, for instance, a particular server version is not compatible with the new JDK 6 library, and then we have to wait until the next server version comes up and stuff like that. Do you think this is going to impact all of that, where they would actually think of committing back to the JDK instead of actually having their own VMs bundled in the servers?
I would be very pleased if they would choose to join in with the OpenJDK community. One of the things that's happened on Glassfish is that we've seen more and more vendors joining in with the Glassfish community. So, Eduardo, do you want to come and just talk about that? Because you've got Allegri Lockhart down here, who is the community lead for Glassfish. And do you want to tell us a little bit about the other vendors who've been involved in the Glassfish community?
I don't know where it applies to your particular case, but in the case of Glassfish, we have seen a lot of participation from a number of different vendors. And it's what Simon was saying. It's all driven by, you can call it wealth or self-interest, by a pretty large metric of what that means. In the case of WebLogic VA, WebLogic Server 10 is using essentially the web services stack from Glassfish, verbatim. I mean, that's why they were able to certify Java EE 5 that quickly. And same thing with TMAX. There are a number of vendors who are in that situation. Now, in the case of Glassfish, because they have a CUDL license, that the dynamics are a bit different. But again, in the case of BEA and many of these guys, they are also a Java EE licensee. So essentially, the Glassfish code is available in three different licenses. Participation in the development and early access to that code as it happens all along, and then at the day they get it in whatever license they want. So it's actually very compelling to them, and they are helping us now with contributions, and they are probably going to start contributing additional code, because moving forward they want to support some of the things that they used to support in their previous web services stack. That's still being negotiated. But yeah.
It's actually interesting to note, when you look at GNU Linux, that actually 26% of the code that's in Debian came from Sun. Not because Sun chose to donate all that code to Debian, but because of the amount of commonality between the code that we're using in Solaris and the code that is in Debian GNU Linux. So every time we fix a bug in GNOME, that actually improves GNU Linux, because GNOME is in both places. Every time Ubuntu fixes a bug in GNOME, that improves Solaris. And that applies across a whole range of software. The great thing about the code development process that begins to happen when you have free and open source software, for the first time in my career, I see code reuse actually happening. Not because of some elaborate code reuse program of an employer, but because with the source code available and with collaborative communities, I can now begin to see distributions assembled from many different sources.
The ClassPath extensions. Could you go into why the LGPL was not sufficient? And could you also comment on existing Java libraries that are covered under the LGPL? Should we be concerned about the LGPL, given that you didn't use it?
No, the question there was about the effects of comparing the merits of LGPL and GPL v2 plus the ClassPath exception. Although the experts on this will find differences in the behaviors issues of the two licenses. Ultimately, the GPL plus the ClassPath exception and the LGPL turn out to have roughly the same effect, and we could easily have picked either as the way that we licensed the Java platform. However, we chose to license it with the GPL v2 and the ClassPath exception for two important reasons. The first reason was because we wanted there to be absolutely no doubt that we intended that this Java platform be completely compatible with GNU Linux. And this licensing style was the one already in use by ClassPath and Cafe, which were the existing projects seeking to produce a compatible Java on GNU Linux. And so by using the exact same licensing style, we were signaling to the free software community that our intent was to produce a completely genuinely free and open Java platform. If we'd used the LGPL, we would have started entertaining exactly these sorts of questions about why we were using the LGPL and not GPL plus ClassPath. Now, as it turned out, I have not since November when we announced it, I've not had a single person question our intent in using the GPL. And so that was completely successful as far as I was concerned. Secondly, if you actually talked, and you can actually ask Eben this question in the next session if you want to, the direction that FSF is taking with GPL licensing is to get away from custom licenses like LGPL and move towards using a single GPL license and then adding to it exceptions that add new freedoms. And so the way that GPL v2 plus path works is exactly the way that you'll see future open source licensing work, having a much smaller number of core licenses and then the use of exception clauses that modify their behavior to suit the community application that they're being applied to. If you actually look at LGPL, LGPL is actually quite a complicated license. It requires a good deal of use of a sushi knife to understand exactly how the thing is going to apply to your particular piece of software. Our view was that it was better to stick with GPL and add an exception to it than it was to use the GPL and be faced with even more explanations in the Linux community. It's very interesting to look at GPL v3 and see that on GPL v3, LGPL v3 is actually GPL v3 plus one extra write. The way that LGPL 3 is being structured is not as a separate license, but actually as an except to the GPL v3. And so that was the pattern that we were following. I don't think there is any particular concern with software that's already licensed under LGPL, and that's for two reasons. First of all, the LGPL is a fine license anyway. And secondly, the LGPL gives you the right to reduce the freedoms in the license down to GPL v2 if you wish to. So any software that you take in under LGPL, you have the freedom to license your derivative work under just the GPL if you choose to. So there is no barrier between code that's licensed under LGPL and the GPL v2 code. So if you want to add something into a GPL licensed Java that has come from an LGPL source, you're completely at liberty to do that.
I have two questions. First of all, with all these new features about the JDK 6 and JavaFX and stuff, is Sun going to drive towards fully sorting all the issues out so that Java 6 / OpenJDK Java 7 will become like a main and first deployed choice of JDK on all the Linux distribution and an additional kind of restricted deployments?
So the direction that we're heading there, we don't have Tom here to talk about that, do we? The direction that we're taking with that is actually we're cooperating with the ClassPath community that produced the version of Java that is already in GNU Linux. So we didn't bring any of them with us to this session. We've actually got Dalibor Topic, who was the author of the maintainer of Cafe, has joined the governance board for OpenJDK. And we've got Mark Villard, who's the maintainer of ClassPath, has agreed to join in with the OpenJDK community right at the beginning. And it's our intent that we would converge as far as we can the work on those two platforms, such that OpenJDK becomes the default Java platform everywhere where Java is installed on GNU Linux. Now, the ClassPath and Cafe guys are going to carry on with their work because they actually enjoy it. But nonetheless, they're actually very excited about working specifically on getting rid of encumbrances that remain on OpenJDK. And we've had several offers of help, very practical offers of help by people who've actually written code, not just offers of help, to eliminate those encumbrances. One of the interesting things that wasn't spoken about this morning is Richard Stallman actually gave us a quote for the press release about OpenJDK, where he encourages the free software community to band together to eliminate the encumbrances in OpenJDK. So I'm expecting we'll see OpenJDK will, over time, become the default installed Java on GNU Linux.
That's great. Another question is, I work in the medical industry, which is a very vertical market. I work for a small company, and the market is dominated by big players. Do you have some sort of advice in terms of strategy to push the open source kind of approach, forcing the big vendors down to agree and cooperate?
You know, it was Dalibor that said in his blog recently that he found he's had very little success with a strategy of trying to blackmail large corporations into behavior they don't want to engage in. And consequently, the best advice I can give is to, wherever you can, use free and open source software. And where no such alternative exists, consider creating it. I've found that there aren't very many of those traditional corporations that are ready to take the shift into co-development at the moment. Even in Sun, it's taken taken us 7 years of heavy lifting to get to where we are now, with both Solaris and Java turned into free software. And we've had to do a huge amount of education inside Sun to make those things happen. So I don't think there is an easy answer to pushing those companies in the direction of using free software. Ultimately, though, I think free software is an economic argument. I think that people want control over their expenditure in their hand. And as I explained, open source puts control, granular control over your expenditure, into your hands as a CIO. And that is what makes people demand it. The other thing is that the more people use free software, the more people will use free software. It seems like a silly thing to say, but if you look in China, you discover that Open Solaris is now on the curriculum of over 100 universities. And that's because the Chinese government has been positive about using Open Solaris for its deployment needs. And as people begin to use open source software, you actually get a much more rapid transition into that model. I mentioned the Brazilians. Their president of their IT institute once said that for Brazil, open source software is a matter of sovereignty. And what he meant by that was that every dollar that he spends on proprietary software gets immediately expatriated to the US, whereas every dollar that he spends on free software goes mostly into the hands of a local developer who grows their skills in their local business and is able to hire staff to work with them. And so as people locally invest in open source and free software, what that does is it builds an industry that grows the momentum of open source and free software. So no easy answers for you there. The question about switching to open source and free software is very much like the argument I used to love having back in 1996 and 7 about whether you should use .NET or Java EE. And the answer was, well, if you're asking the question, you're not the person that makes the decision. Because ultimately, the difference between .NET and Java EE is whether you want to have somebody else managing your architecture or whether you want to have your architect managing your architecture. And that decision is made by someone other than the technical analyst.
So ultimately, in a way, it's leverage Java, open source, and everybody in terms of features leveraging it and then go.
I couldn't hear that.
Sorry. Ultimately, it's probably leveraging Java and forging ahead with an open source model, and that way getting ahead of the big competitors and bringing them in light, maybe, but maybe just winning it over.
So I'm personally convinced. So we've had this discussion in between around Solaris and GNU Linux as well. And I debate. People want to draw me into the debate and get me to say bad things about GNU Linux. And I don't want to. You know, what I actually want to do is focus on Solaris and focus on making Solaris succeed. And similarly, when it comes to being an advocate of open source and free software, basically the thing is to engage with it, to go participate and use the software. Because when you do that, you produce the effects that make it succeed. Advocacy is much less important than use when it comes to free software, because the multiplier for making free software accelerate is through that local investment. So I think just focusing on Java as free software is the key to getting it to propagate, rather than trying to engage in advocacy.
Can you explain the differences between the, I guess, commercial Java SE version and JDK?
I can do a better job than that. I can get Ray Gantz to come up here. Ray Gantz is the community manager for OpenJDK. Carla's going to come and do it, because very shy on you, Ray.
As Simon mentioned, right now there's still a little bit of code that came from third parties that we haven't been able to open source. And so hoping to do with the community is to create alternative versions of that software that would be used in OpenJDK. In some cases, we might take that back and release it as part of the commercial code. In some cases, we might not. It's going to be a case-by-case question of performance, quality, and so forth. The goal is to have the code base that's OpenJDK and the production software that we're going to continue to do to be as close to the same thing as possible. But we expect there to be a few small differences like I just mentioned. We also expect that folks in the OpenJDK community will be working on ports that Sun may not want to take in and ship and support and so forth. So we would support them in the OpenJDK community, but might not ever be released as part of our production-supported software, for example. But as much as possible, these things will be the same.
So Eduardo, Java EE.
So on our side, it's the same thing. I mean, we accept that pretty much all our code is open source. We're going to have ports that just going to support right now. Canonical, neither Canonical nor Sun provides real support for production support for the port Ubuntu. We might if somebody asked us for it, but at this point it's not in our product plan.
Will it be clearly identified, like what the differences are, or people using the commercial version to be able to tell, okay, this area of the code base is not available or differs from the OpenJDK version?
So OpenJDK includes full instance of the JRE and of the JDK. And the way we've achieved that is when you build from OpenJDK, there are some binary components that represent the things that we've not been able to open source yet. So actually, if you go and build OpenJDK, you'll discover it is identical in function with the commercial release of the Java platform. The difference is that because we built the Java platform as it stands at the moment, we feel that we're in a position to be able to support it and service it. Whereas if you built it, we actually don't know how you did that. And so it's kind of harder for us to offer a support service. Now, going forward, I'm encouraging Sun to take the attitude, if we employ the engineers that write the source, we ought to support the bit. Getting to that place is going to take us a little while, because there's a lot of people who say, you know, how do I tell the difference between open source and the real thing? And telling them that open source is the real thing doesn't make them feel good, because they didn't see, you know, it doesn't have a part number on the bottom and they didn't see it being compiled. But the place that Sun is going to end up at is probably a very similar place to the place that Canonical is at with Ubuntu today, where they're producing regular releases, and every now and then one of those releases will be blessed as the long-term support version. And that is the equivalent of the full product. But we're not in that place yet. That's definitely a future direction. Ray, you wanted to object to me saying that they were just absolutely identical with each other.
So one of the encumbrances that we have is the font rasterizer. This is the bit of code that draws fonts and characters on the screen. And that is not owned by Sun. We're not able to make this available as open source. All right, we've tried and can't do it. So there are other font rasterizers out there, and we will be releasing what we have right now, as Simon says, as a binary that can be linked into it. What we'd like to do is replace it as quickly as possible with one of these other font rasterizers. Now, we got a problem, right? Because not every font rasterizer is going to behave just the same and do the kerning and the hinting, the anti-aliasing, and all the different things that font rasterizers do exactly the same. But people are depending that if I run my program on this and it draws a character in this way, that if I do it on a next update release, it'll do it exactly the same. Some people care about it more than other people. So initially, when we do replace one, which we will as soon as possible, it probably won't be exactly identical. This may take some time before we can actually converge it. And during that period of time, there may be some slight differences. It will make a big deal of difference to some and not so many to others. So what we'd like to do is certainly have all clear, one code base, but it may take a bit of time to get there.
What do you think the time frame is for that to completely be there?
Help us. You know, honestly, the more help and assistance that we get in this, the more rapid it will go. If people aren't interested and are going to wait for Sun to do everything, you know, we'll get it done eventually, but we're kind of judging the amount of urgency and priority based on the amount of interest out there in the community. And certainly we want to help, but we've been working on this for a long period of time. We're still going to be doing our production releases, all right? And, you know, but we also want to participate as much as possible.
I was wondering if you had a few words about some of the issues that are being addressed by the Free Software Foundation and GPL v3.
Actually, that question would be better left to the next panel when Evan can answer them directly.
Okay.
Generally speaking, the GPL Sun's position on GPL 3 is we're looking forward to it being finished.
Okay. Thank you.
And Evan tells me that's going to be June. Peter Brown from the FSF is also here at the conference this week. He tells me it's going to be June. I tell him it's going to be August, and we kind of smile at each other. So split the difference, and it's going to be ready in July. Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much for coming along this afternoon, and you're welcome to stay to the next session.